Does Miami Beach pay its fair share for the homeless? Why did so many black voters opt for Trump? And what would Marco Rubio do in Latin America as Secretary of State? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the dispute between Miami-Dade County and Miami Beach that just resulted in the beach ponying up $10 million to the county's homeless trust. We'll also discuss why Donald Trump won so many black, especially black male, votes in South Florida. Is it a sexist thing, as Barack Obama said, or something deeper? And we'll examine what to expect from Marco Rubio if he's confirmed as Trump's top diplomat in Latin America and its ties to China. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. In last week's election, we thought Miami Beach residents were going to vote on a 1% food and beverage tax for homelessness and domestic violence services. But then, even as early votes were being cast on the issue, the Miami Beach City Commission pulled it off the ballot. Commissioner David Suarez said the ballot issue was, quote, purposely engineered to mislead and take advantage of taxpayer money. Miami Beach, he insisted, already has a means of funding aid for homelessness. But Miami-Dade County is saying not so fast. It accuses Miami Beach of benefiting from the county's homeless trust while not paying its own fair share for homelessness services. And so it ordered Miami Beach to pony up $10 million to the trust. Yesterday, the Miami Beach Commission agreed to pay it. But this dispute speaks to a larger and important question as our affordable housing crisis deepens and a new state homeless law takes effect. Who should pay for what to help the homeless in our communities? What's your take? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to help make sense of this is Miami Beach District 6 Commissioner Joe Magazine, whose proposal led to yesterday's resolution of the dispute with Miami-Dade County. Also with me here in the studio is WLRN's government accountability reporter Joshua Ceballos and Carlton Gillespie, WLRN's reporter in Broward County, which is also wrestling with homelessness issues like these. Commissioner Magazine, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
It's a beautiful Friday. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, we appreciate, as I said, you helping us make sense of this. I want to start with you and update our listeners on what happened yesterday at the Miami Beach City Commission meeting. As I mentioned earlier, the commission did in the end vote to pay Miami-Dade County the $10 million it had demanded for the homeless trust as a result of Miami Beach taking the 1% tax for homeless services off the ballot. What exactly was the proposal you recommended, Commissioner Magazine, that convinced the rest of the commission to go along with that payment, and will the county approve that proposal?
Yes, I appreciate you laying that out on the table. So yesterday, what we did is we have always wanted to be a supportive partner for regional issues such as homelessness. In 2021, the previous commission did strike a deal with the Homeless Trust to put a 1% sales tax on the ballot. That also came with some terms and agreements that were specifically noted that they would be agreed to in writing before this went on the ballot. However, the Homeless Trust did not hold up that end of the bargain. So going forward with that ballot measure just would not have been proper. It obviously was incredibly unideal timing, having that already go out to some voters and taking that off the ballot, but it would have been a dereliction of duty not protecting the Miami Beach residents. However, yesterday, we showed our commitment and our support to the county, to our regional partners, and to organizations like the Homeless Trust in finding an alternative revenue source that, one, does not raise any new taxes on Miami Beach residents. The 1% homeless tax actually would have taxed our smallest mom and pop businesses. Any business restaurant with over $400,000 in revenue would have been hit by this. And what was really unfortunate is that ballot measure would have excluded the largest businesses that could most easily accommodate a 1% sales tax, such as hotels. So this was really going to hit the mom and pop shops and our residents that frequent them.
So explain the alternative then that you came up with that the commission found palatable.
Yes, the alternative is once the Convention Center Hotel is built, which will be a key economic driver across Miami-Dade County and catering to wealthy conventioneers, Miami Beach was already set to receive a 4% hotel resort tax once that construction is completed and the convention center is up and running. So now we will divert that 4% hotel tax to the county and in support of our recognition that homelessness is a regional issue that we all need to be partners of. So what we really did is shift that burden from our mom and pop businesses and the residents that frequent them to a convention center hotel.
Is that not making an assumption, though, that this new project will actually generate enough revenue to accommodate that $10 million payment you need to make?
Yes. So I worked very, very closely with the development team there, really worked to understand their financial projections. And the county is safeguarded because the projected revenue are going to be well above the $4 million per year that this tax is going to derive. And in the event of a black swan scenario where, for some reason, that does not happen, the county will be safeguarded because there will be a sweep of the excess RDA surplus funds that
Okay.
exists right now. So they really have some
Okay.
downside protection.
But Commissioner, one gets the feeling that this does not really resolve in the long term the underlying disagreement between Miami Beach and Miami-Dade about what Miami Beach's obligation to the homeless trust should be. And for that matter, what any municipality's obligation is to the county when it comes to services for people experiencing homelessness. Can you walk us through what you see as the elements of that dispute that, as I said, in the long run are also going to have to be worked out, not just in the short run?
Yes, I would actually slightly disagree with that because this $4 million per year commitment that is going to run for the next 15 years is well above and beyond what our fair share is. So that 1% ballot measure on a net basis would have actually only sent about $2.5 to $3 million to the county after we were reimbursed for the spending that we do on the city. So Miami Beach is actually going to be contributing $4 million to the county and then continue our spending within our city, which equates to about $5 to $7 million per year. So when we look on a absolute basis, Miami Beach is contributing well over $10 million to our regional homeless efforts. And that
Yeah.
$4 million number, we've gotten good indication from the county that they feel that's very sufficient.
Okay. Josh Ceballos, I want to ask you, as a journalist who's been watching this dispute, to take us back to how all this really began. I think we need some context here. Even before the Miami Beach Commission's decision to scratch the 1% food and beverage tax question from the city's election ballot last week, and I'm including here, for example, controversies like Miami-Dade County's seemingly unilateral move to shelter homeless persons in a Miami Beach hostel shortly before the election. Walk us through how we got to this point, please.
Yeah, I'll try and do that succinctly, Tim. So basically, the Homeless Trust is the county body that deals with all the money and all the programs that have to do with homeless services. So they fund beds at Camilla's house, they fund homeless outreach programs, and their mission is to get people off the streets. They want people to be in shelters or in housing. And out of the 34 municipalities in Miami-Dade County, 31 of them pay a 1% food and beverage tax that goes towards the trust to pay for those services. Three municipalities don't: Miami Beach, Bell Harbor, and Surfside.
Okay.
And the Homeless Trust also gets federal funding for these kinds of things. So the Homeless Trust has been trying for years to get Miami Beach to opt into this 1% tax. In 2021, as the commissioner alluded to, Ron Book, who is the chair of the Homeless Trust, went to Miami Beach and was lobbying them to put this on the ballot. And the part of the dispute between Miami Beach commissioners and the Homeless Trust is that Miami Beach wanted to be made whole for the money they already spend on homeless services in their city.
Okay.
They said, if we're going to opt into this tax, we want to be reimbursed for what we've already been paying for homeless services here on the beach. Ron Book said at the time that he would make them whole and pay for some of these things. And I've just gotten off the phone with Ron Book, actually.
Okay.
And he told me that what was contemplated was that the Homeless Trust would reimburse Miami Beach for services that were within their existing continuum. So they wouldn't pay for the Homeless Trust wouldn't pay for like police services because they don't do police services, but they would pay for like the homeless outreach that Miami Beach does. That was a conflict in Miami Beach in 2021. They did put it on a straw ballot question, which means it's non-binding, asking residents if they wanted to ask the state to give them this 1% tax, and they said yes. Right. So that's sort of the origins of this, and now fast forward to now, and an actual ballot question that would have opted the city into the 1% tax was on the ballot, and commissioners scrapped it while early voting was underway, right. And I believe about 20,000 people had already
voted. I think a lot of people were kind of stunned to see that a ballot question could be nullified even after early voting had started, but the Miami Beach Commission's move was upheld in court, mm-hmm. right? Why did a judge say this is okay to do?
So basically, the judge said that the plaintiffs, a couple of Miami Beach residents, sued the city in court saying, hey, we were already voting on this. The city shouldn't be allowed to rescind it while we're voting. And the judge said that the plaintiffs did not have standing, that the reason this was on the ballot is because the commission passed a resolution to do so.
Okay.
And they could rescind their own resolution.
So
they had the power to do that.
They had that prerogative.
Yeah. Okay, and they did that. And they put that on the agenda before early voting was underway.
Right. That's good context. Thank you. Commissioner Magazine, Josh here just mentioned the sort of homeless czar, as it were, Ron Book, who runs Miami-Dade County's Homeless Trust. But others, like county commissioners like Eileen Higgins, insist that Miami Beach's move to scrap the 1% tax for homeless services was an act of bad faith. Miami Beach has countered that Mr. Book and the county have also been acting in bad faith. You just heard what Josh conveyed to us was Mr. Book's response to this. How would you respond to Mr. Book's explanation about why, he was not acting in bad faith with Miami Beach on this? Do we still have Mr. Commissioner Magazine with
us? Okay. Yes. Yep. I appreciate that. So, and this is my goal really is to look forward and move this forward. However, Josh's comments that he received from Mr. Book point to the problem of having this go forward on the ballot because it's on public record. Mr. Book was as clear as day that reimbursement for Miami Beach would include our police services. He said that in no uncertain terms. It's on our public record. It's in our video archives from December 2021. So the fact that there was so much ambiguity when something was being introduced on the ballot shows just all the more reason that it really wasn't in the proper context to move forward. However, finding this alternative revenue source simplifies the logistics of things and really shows Miami Beach's commitment to helping out our county partners, the Homeless Trust, with this regional issue. We just didn't feel that the dynamics of that previously agreed to deal were in good faith and ready to go forward.
All right. This is the South Florida Roundup. I'm WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Joshua Ceballos and Carlton Gillespie about the standoffs we're seeing between our county and municipal governments on the increasingly important question of who should pay what to help the homeless. I'm also speaking with Miami Beach Commissioner Joe Magazine. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Carlton Gillespie, I want to bring you into the discussion here from the Broward County perspective. I know, for example, that the county has asserted that certain municipalities have not pitched in enough when it comes to providing affordable housing there. Is the same sort of tension playing out when it comes to shelters and other services for the homeless?
Well, there's certainly a tension between amongst the municipalities. For instance, Fort Lauderdale, because they have the jail and the court system there, when homeless people are picked off the street and put in jail, they're released out of the jail in Fort Lauderdale, and they stay in Fort Lauderdale. So Fort Lauderdale certainly feels like they take in homeless individuals from across the county and they aggregate there. They have more homeless
people. More so than other municipalities do in the county.
Yeah, and that's driven their recent push. They've taken the new state law, HB 1365, as a kind of a jumping off point. The law says to ban overnight camping. Fort Lauderdale wants to do raids during the day and at night to stop people from camping all across
the
city.
And what does the county say about that?
The county does not like this. They want to come up with a different proposal, one that they feel is much more humane than Fort Lauderdale's. But Fort Lauderdale and the mayor, Dean Tarantellis, has said this number of times that this is the solution he wants going forward.
So I'm glad you brought up the new law. The new state law that essentially outlaws people experiencing homelessness camping out or sleeping or staying otherwise in public spaces. Does a factor like that, though, make better coordination between Broward County and its local governments all the more important from what you're hearing up there.
Yeah, Broward County likes to think of itself as the county of cooperation, and that's going to certainly be tested. So one of the ideas that the county has come up with is to build these kind of tiny home shelters as transitional housing on either unincorporated Broward County land or land they'd have to purchase from a municipality.
Right.
Currently, one of the options bandied about is in Dania Beach. So it would require coordination from Dania Beach to do this.
Yeah.
So they've said they're going to need the cities and the municipalities on board. They're also reaching out to the philanthropic and faith-based organizations. For example, mm-hmm. there's a pallet shelter in Tampa
that
was started by the Archdiocese of Tampa in conjunction with the city. So the United Way has already pledged to match the city's budgeted funds. It's only $750,000, so nearly a stepping stone, but they're starting to kind of generate that, and it's going to be absolutely crucial.
Commissioner Magazine, let me put that same question to you as well. Given the new state law that cracks down on the homeless in public spaces, how should Miami-Dade County and municipalities like Miami Beach be better coordinating and cooperating with one another as we move forward in these efforts?
Yeah, so Miami Beach and our county as a whole is a very compassionate city. We are going to do everything that we can and provide the resources that we have at our disposal to help those that are truly in need, those that need the resources, that we can get them on the right track. That being said, it's not compassionate for either the homeless individuals or our community to allow people to continue living on the street. And oftentimes embedded amongst this element is a criminal element. 37% of crimes in Miami Beach are actually committed by the homeless. And me, myself, I was actually a victim just several months ago of a violent crime by a homeless individual that came to our community for no other reason than to prey on our residents. And I was held up at gunpoint with a gun put to my chest. So we're an incredibly compassionate city, but it's not compassionate to allow people to live on our streets, to fall through the cracks. So we will get those that want the resources, the help that they need. But for those that just want to, you know, make our public rights of way their homes, that's just not possible in Miami Beach and in Miami-Dade and Florida as a whole.
Well, we have a caller on the line, Vicky from Weston. Vicky, what are your perspectives on the situation? And welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi, thank you very much. Yes, so my perspective is that the law that our governor is following now and everybody else is following is actually not compassionate at all. And I'm sorry that the gentleman had an incident. However, what we're doing, arresting the homeless people, and everybody is homeless for a different reason, I think we can all attest to that, is that they're stripping them, I think.
Vicky, I'm sorry, we're sort of losing you. I think the connection we have with you is kind of tattered here. I'm sorry. We'll have to drop the call. But as she said, Commissioner Magazine, we are sorry that you had to experience that incident. We're just about out of time here, Josh Tobias. I want to give you the last word here in terms of context. That same question with this new law breathing down counties and municipalities' necks here in Florida concerning the homeless. Is there a compromise path here that you hear officials sort of putting forward as to how counties and local governments can just do this better together?
Not that I'm hearing anything that's in the works. I really think what would make this more coordinated if there was a framework maybe from the state level to actually deal with this in a way that wasn't just criminalizing, that wasn't just jailing people, mm-hmm. but actually creating a framework for more affordable housing, more transitional housing and supportive housing. That doesn't exist right now. And I think everybody's just kind of playing this game of shuffling homeless people into other cities, because while they want to deal with this, I think people don't want, governments don't always want the homeless population in their city.
Right. And we should also mention that this is not just a Miami Beach thing. We've had municipalities like Cutler Bay having clashes with the homeless trust in Miami-Dade County, having to do with, as you just pointed out, transitional housing coming into their communities.
I think everyone knows we have to deal with the problem, but I think no one really knows how, or no one really wants to have it in their city.
Right. Well, let's hope the learning curve is not that steep. We'll have to leave it there. We've been talking with Miami Beach City Commissioner Joe Magazine, WLRN Government Accountability Reporter Joshua Ceballos, and WLRN Broward County Reporter Carlton Gillespie. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Still to come, what drove so many black voters here to Donald Trump? That is this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. There was a lot of talk last week about Donald Trump picking up a record share of the Latino vote for a Republican presidential candidate, 45%, which was even higher in South Florida. But the bigger story, frankly, was the jump in the share of the black vote that Trump won, 13% compared to 8% in 2020, in an election where one of the candidates, Kamala Harris, was a black woman. Here in Miami Gardens, a city whose population is two-thirds black, Trump won a remarkable quarter of the vote. Election analysts pointed out most of the black Trump vote was male. And so former President Barack Obama, America's first black president, pointedly asked black men if this was a sexist issue. Were they uncomfortable with the idea of a woman president? Or is it deeper than that? Were many black men and black women simply tired of being taken for granted by the Democratic Party? Did they carry the same economic discontents into this election that white and Latinos voiced so loudly? Why do you think this once reliable Democratic bloc saw a Trump-ward shift last week? Call us at 800-743-WLRM, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to delve into this is Valencia Gunder. She's co-founder and treasurer of the Black Collective, a black community empowerment nonprofit here in Miami. Also with us is Emmanuel George, a South Florida black community historian and arts activist known for his Instagram page, Black Broward. Valencia, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for
really
having me.
Really appreciate it. I just first want to get your sense about the black voter data that's been coming in. As I mentioned, a jump from 8% to 13% for Donald Trump nationwide in the black vote. Is that a significant enough increase to warrant all the media speculation we're hearing about a black voter shift, as it were? Or is perhaps too much being made of this?
I think a lot is being made out of it. I think, one, people are definitely getting tired of the Democratic strategy. Right. But I also don't feel as if like black people are jumping into the Republican Party because of that.
Yeah.
I think also, you know, a lot of conversation was around the economics. And, you know, I think you do have a block of black people who think in that mindset, and they thought that was the best decision for them without thinking about the rest of their lives. They just thought about one framework.
Yeah.
But I think the numbers were not that big enough for us to feel
right.
feel nervous. I know.
Yeah, and I want to, you make a good point that the number toward Trump maybe was not that big, but I want to frame it in this perspective though. Either way, most people thought that since we had a black woman, Kamala Harris, on the ballot, that would have actually reduced the black vote for Trump, not augment it. What has been the impact in the black community, especially for black women, realizing that the opposite actually played out?
Right. So one, shout out to black women because we showed up on the right side of history. Only 7% of black women voted for Donald Trump. The rest of us understood the assignment. You know, when it comes to black women leadership, it's constantly being questioned. She was questioned if she could do the job. She was questioned if she would be a good leader and all of these things. And I think it was a very sexist mindset. Like, can a woman do the job? And on top of that, can a black woman do the job? Is she educated enough? Does she have enough experience? Even though she's been in a political career for over, 30 years
right.
almost, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, she was the vice president of the United States of America. And I'm not saying like I'm the biggest fan, but if, you know, we gave America 45 times to let a man do it, you know, I thought that we could give a woman a chance in this
yeah.
state.
Yeah.
And I lastly want to say that black women are constantly being questioned about their abilities in the United States. Like, we don't help build the economics of this community. Like, we are not the most educated population in the Black community. Yeah. Like, we have shown and proved that we can do these jobs, and we're just constantly being told that we can't do it.
No, that's an important, very important point for us to keep in mind. Emmanuel, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anytime. Thank you.
Let me ask you the same question, but from a little different perspective. Latino voters, for example, are constantly being asked these days, how can so many of them vote for Trump when we've seen so many racist, anti-Latino remarks and actions from him? And now I hear the same thing regarding Black voters. How could they opt for Trump, given the lies he pushed, for example, about Haitians during this election? But again, was there enough of a Black vote for Trump last week to warrant all of this, you know, media hand-wringing that we're seeing?
To my understanding, based on the statistics that I've seen, I mean, Black women were the most progressive voting bloc, but second behind them was Black men. So there has been a little bit of a shift of a few Black male voters, but oftentimes I feel as if that's a little bit exaggerated. And then it's like it's always emphasized on the few particular Black men who are voting for, who are saying that they are voting for Trump. And oftentimes they're the most vocal.
Yeah.
But, you know, statistically, it's still most men, Black men are voting for Trump. One of the things I would say is like there is a huge level of misinformation that is happening out there. I mean, even on the debate, sorry, there was discussions about fact checking being an issue. And with the things, with the way things are going on in the future with the likes of Elon Musk and running things with Twitter, it's a concern for the future, which is my main concern, and more so is the level of misinformation that's happening.
But Emmanuel, again, the same question that I put to Valencia just a second ago about the fact that having a Black candidate on the ballot did not, in the end, pull more Black voters away from Trump, as I think was expected. How is the Black community itself absorbing that unexpected outcome?
That's a good question. From what I can see over here is that a lot of folks were being very critical because there is issues amongst the Democratic Party. There is a lot of symbolic issues that tends to happen as opposed to sometimes, you know, real impactful change. And I feel as if some folks, you know, with the way things were going with inflation, even though inflation is actually getting better on a national level, but still many people were a bit misinformed with like the way groceries are still at a high level.
And I want to get to that economic issue of things in a little bit. Valencia, as I mentioned, election analysts tell us a lot, if not most, of this Black voter turnout for Trump was driven by Black men. Let's cut straight to what a lot of people consider the rather uncomfortable suggestion former President Barack Obama raised, which is that Black men, as he put it, just weren't comfortable with the idea of a woman as president of the United States. Do you feel there's some truth to what he was saying? And if so, why?
I think it was some of that. I do think that for sure. I think, patriarchy mixed with capitalism, mixed with sexism came up a lot, right? I mean, from us, like at the Black Collective, we actually did this thing called the Noir Project where we talked to 10,000 Black people in person here across the county. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting to see why people were not participating in democracy, right? And, you know, people keep saying like, we don't think America is ready for a woman president. We don't think America is ready for a Black women's president. And, you know, after Barack Obama, a lot of Black people were like, we're not just voting for people because they're Black anymore. Mm-hmm. That was another thing that came out of the Barack Obama administration. Mm-hmm. We saw the number increase because of different reasons. But I think, honestly, it was just because people didn't trust her because she was a woman. And oftentimes, I mean, even in the workplace sometimes, like when you're in a male dominant sector of work, you constantly hear people saying like, this is not a place for a woman. Right. A woman can't do it. A woman is too emotional to make decisions on this magnitude, which is actually untrue.
So there's a possibility there that for Black men, her gender actually turned out to matter more than her race.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
Emmanuel, was this, as Obama suggested, a sexist thing among a lot of Black men? I mean, if it is, what's driving that attitude? Were a lot of Black male voters as attracted to the Trump masculinity thing as young white male voters obviously were? Or if that's not the case, what are the deeper factors at play here among Black male voters that people, especially the Democratic Party, need to pay more attention to?
I mean, I agree with Valencia. There was definitely a lot of sexism at play as to why a few Black men were not voting for Kamala. Seeing it on social media posts where, you know, they would focus on the minuscule of things, while, as you know, Trump was able to, you know, develop concepts of plans and things like that, and she basically had to be like perfect, you know. So there is still a sense of, you know, men not wanting to be led by women, even though historically, you know, women have always often led men in history. So it is a complex issue that still needs to be addressed amongst the, you know, the few mm-hmm. Black men there.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Valencia Gunder of the Black Collective and Emmanuel George of Black Broward about the surprising share of the Black vote here that went to Donald Trump last week. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We have Michael from Fort Lauderdale on the line. Michael, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your perspectives?
Thanks, Tim. Hi, this is Magic Mike from BLM Broward. Hey, Emmanuel. Hey, Val. I just wanted to share a little bit on my perspective. I think that, I mean, we cannot rule out misogyny, you know, playing a big role in why that shift happened among Black men. But I think that we can also really point to the Democratic strategy of not, like Emmanuel said, actually talking about the meat and potato issues, the economic issues that really concern people. Families are trying to tell the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, that our families are suffering. And then what they came back with was, Bidenomics is working. We have the best economy ever because it's working well for businesses. It's working well for, you know, the people who have the ability to get into the stock market, which is not most Americans and certainly not most Black Americans. Mm-hmm. And so not having a really solid answer to that in terms of what you're going to do to improve the economy for everyone, especially for Black Americans, yeah. And not just talking about people who have the desire and ability to get into entrepreneurship, but just regular everyday working people.
Right.
The Democrats have abandoned working class people and especially working class Black people. Well, and that's the long and short of it.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for that perspective. We really appreciate it. Valencia, on a more local level then, going to what Michael was just speaking about, do you think that what he was just pointing out played out, for example, in Miami Gardens, where, as I pointed out, 2/3 of the population is Black, but gave almost a quarter of its vote to Trump?
Yeah. I think he is correct along those lines. Like, people do feel as if like the Biden-Harris administration were not super helpful for the middle class or the lower class families, the working class families.
We should point out, just like Latinos, the Black community, more than half of that community lives in rental housing, as opposed
right.
to only a quarter of white Americans. And
right.
renters really took it on the chin during inflation, right?
Yes. And, you know, I think like this, you know, people voted red in the hopes to protect wealth that they don't have. That they don't have to acquire,
yeah.
right?
Uh-huh.
And honestly, I feel as if like on a local level, it is just like this miscommunication. Like people think like, oh, we vote red, we're going to get more money, we're going to get these things. But remember, Donald Trump was the president before
right.
Joe Biden,
yeah.
and we were in this same economic issue when he was in office. Like, Black people were still struggling economically. Black people could barely buy groceries. Housing was an issue. All those things were issues. Not like we were living in a utopia when he was president before. So this mindset to think that, oh, we shift over, it's going to shift the economics. That's not necessarily true, at least on the local level, right?
Right.
Miami is not one of the most expensive cities to live in the whole United States of America.
Yeah.
So our economic status won't actually shift until we make better decisions as a locale.
Right. Emmanuel, in the minute we just have left here for this segment, do you think that the Democratic Party, despite everything we've just been pointing out, still has a chance to reverse this trend? I don't want to call it a trend, but this movement that we saw last week, that the Democratic Party can reverse that with Black voters?
I think it's going to be something interesting to see within the next 4 years. I am still very optimistic that there can be some change for the better, but we're going to have to see. I'm very more focused on the now and what we as a people in the community can do and can mm-hmm. come together and work on,
yeah.
because we see that the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court is all in Trump's favor.
Right.
But my thing is like, okay, are we going to still be reactionary, or are we going to at least maybe start organizing a lot more in our local communities?
Well, thanks. Emmanuel George is a South Florida Black community historian known for his Instagram page, Black Broward. Valencia Gunder is co-founder of the Black Collective. Many, many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, what would a Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, affect America's Latin America policy and the encroachment of China? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Yesterday, Chinese President Xi Jinping came to Peru to help inaugurate a new multi-billion dollar deep water megaport. It's Communist China's largest infrastructure investment yet in Latin America, a region where Beijing keeps planting not just its economic but political influence in ways that have set off alarm bells in Washington. That Chinese incursion is one of the most important hemispheric challenges facing Florida Senator Marco Rubio, the Miami native president-elect Donald Trump nominated this week to be his Secretary of State. But it's hardly the only crisis awaiting Rubio in Latin America. The conservative Cuban-American, who's known as a bit of a foreign policy hawk, will have to confront leftist dictatorships in Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, not to mention the powerful gangs that rule Haiti today. The big question is, will Rubio be the first Secretary of State in a long time to make Latin America a priority? How are you expecting Marco Rubio to approach Latin America and China's relationship with it? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to ponder those questions are Leland Lazarus. He's the Associate Director of National Security at Florida International University's Gordon Institute and an expert on Latin America-China relations. Also with us from FIU is the Gordon Institute's director, Brian Fonseca, an expert on Latin American security issues. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having us.
Leland Lazarus, let's start there in Peru with that new Chancay megaport. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Chancay, which seems to be an intersection of two of Marco Rubio's foreign policy obsessions, Latin America and China. How serious would you characterize, Leland, the Chinese incursion in Latin America, the dramatic increase in trade and infrastructure development projects we've seen between the region and Beijing so far in this century? And how do you think we can expect Rubio as Secretary of State to confront it?
Well, Tim, first and foremost, starting with the port of Chancay, it has the potential to really revolutionize the maritime route between China and South America.
Right.
And so when it becomes inaugurated or is already inaugurated, it will be one of the largest deep water ports in all of South America. It will cut down the trade route or the shipping route from Peru to China by at least 10 days, saving millions of dollars.
Wow, yeah.
Peru will be able to directly ship its copper, which China desperately needs in order to continue to produce electric vehicle batteries, data centers, in order to train its AI models. And on the flip side, China will be able to now directly export its electric vehicles, its electric vehicle batteries, and solar panels directly to South America. And I think that Chancay is really a microcosm of the increase of Chinese influence that we've really seen over the past decade, or really 2 decades.
Right.
Chinese trade between itself and Latin America has really ballooned from $18 billion 2 decades ago to almost $400 billion this year. And it's really expanded well beyond just raw materials right. to include the Belt and Road Initiative.
But
so I think it's very concerning from the part of national security experts in the United States and abroad.
But Leland, this week a report in the Wall Street Journal, pegged obviously to the opening of the Chancay port in Peru, essentially accused the United States of just sitting by while China grows its footprint like that in this hemisphere. Do you think Senator Rubio is of that opinion as well? And if so, what do you think he'll counsel President Trump to do to make the U.S. more proactive in the region to blunt China?
Yeah, well, I mean, first and foremost, over the past several years, Marco Rubio has really been one of the strongest and most vociferous advocates for more U.S. engagement in Latin America and the Caribbean. You know, people have called it the backyard. I prefer to call it, our neighborhood. But it's so true that there has been a lack of consistency in terms of U.S. private sector engagement in Latin America. And I think that's opened a real opportunity for Chinese companies to get into the game.
Well, again, how do you see a Secretary of State Marco Rubio now then confronting that?
Yeah, I mean, under the first Trump administration, they had a initiative called the Americas Grows Initiative, or America Crece, which was to really encourage and inspire more U.S. private companies to invest in the kind of key infrastructure that Chinese companies are investing in. And to be honest, there's been quite a bit of continuity there under the Biden administration, you know, the APEP, America Partnerships for Economic Prosperity. I would assume that a U.S. foreign policy led by Secretary Rubio would continue to double down on that, whether it be empowering entities like the Development Finance Corporation to really support U.S. private sector investment in mines, in ports, mm-hmm. and other key infrastructure in the region. I think that'll be what we'll continue to see.
Brian Fonseca, China is, of course, another reason that America's biggest adversaries in Latin America, and I'm talking here mostly about the so-called Troika of Tyranny, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, the reason that they've been able to survive. I mean, Russia, too, plays a role in propping up these regimes. So does Iran. As I mentioned at the outset, as a senator, Marco Rubio has had a rather hawkish reputation when it comes to both these authoritarian Latin American regimes and their powerful patrons like China. What do you expect, Brian, to see Rubio do as Secretary of State to try to break that dynamic?
No, it's a great question. Again, thanks so much for having us on. So, I mean, first, let me take a brief step back, Tim, because I think what's really important is that, you know, again, framing Latin America in the broader American foreign policy landscape, I think, is really important. I agree that I think Senator Rubio, soon to be Secretary of State Rubio, is probably going to increase his emphasis on the Americas. But, you know, there's often a running joke that policy for the Americas doesn't always make it into the Oval Office because of the multiple fires happening across the world in Iran, in North Korea, Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Hamas. Those things are likely going to be some of the more important issues that Secretary of State Rubio will have to have.
It's like the old adage about journalism. Americans will do anything for Latin America except read about it.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, again, while Senator Rubio is going to want to put emphasis on the Americas, there may be some real pull factors that don't let him, you know, engage in the Americas as much as he wants to. That said, the areas in the Americas where he's definitely going to focus, and you started to highlight it, sort of displacing American rivals from the region, obviously the border issue and immigration policy is going to at some point come on his plate because that's a big, you know, part of the sort of the Trump's platform. And then, of course, taking it to authoritarian regimes, the Troika of Tyranny that Bolton put out there years ago, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. And I think in that context, some of the things I'm going to expect, you know, a Secretary of State Rubio to do is double down on things like sanctions. He's been a huge advocate of sanctions, and I think that he's probably going to double down on those. I think he's also been, as evident in Venezuela in 2019, a huge proponent of propping up opposition movements. And so you may see more emphasis and funding, sort of channeled to, activist communities or sort of activist exile communities or opposition movements in order to sort of prop those movements up against those authoritarian regimes.
But Brian, you just mentioned immigration, and that represents a diplomatic tightrope that Rubio, as Secretary of State, will have to walk between cracking down on regimes like Cuba and Venezuela, but also containing all of the illegal immigration that's coming out of those countries, which tightening the screws on sanctions, et cetera, could only exacerbate, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Again, part of the negotiations between the Biden administration and Venezuela sort of revolved around helping contain, sort of outflows of migration through the Central American corridor into the United States in exchange for, backing off or at least creating some reprieve in terms of or in the form of sanctions relief. Those two things might come into conflict, which is where you're probably going to see a Secretary of State Rubio put far more effort on partners in places like Mexico, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, in which he's probably going to become, again, far more hawkish, but far more engaged in sort of trying to stop that sort of Central American corridor movement.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with FIU's Leland Lazarus and Brian Fonseca about what awaits Florida Senator Marco Rubio in Latin America, including China, if he's confirmed as President-elect Trump's Secretary of State. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Leland, I want to go back for a moment to the China conundrum in Latin America that Marco Rubio will have to confront as Secretary of State. And I specifically want to address a part of the region that gets too little attention from Washington, the Caribbean. Caribbean leaders say they'd be more than happy to turn away from China if the U.S. would simply do more, for example, to help them with climate change mitigation and economic nearshoring. Can we expect a conservative Republican like Rubio, who hasn't proven to be all that receptive to things like climate change mitigation and foreign policy, to move the Trump administration or the next Trump administration in a direction like that to help keep China off the hemispheric street, as it were?
That's a good question, Tim. When I served as a U.S. diplomat in the Caribbean, it was at the end of the Obama administration and during the Trump administration. And what I saw was that many of the programs that we were doing to support our Caribbean partners were essentially repackaged, right? Maybe we didn't call it climate change anymore, but we called it the U.S.-Caribbean Resilience Partnership, right? And so resilience is a much more palatable word than sort of climate change. And I expect some form of that will happen in the future. But I do want to highlight that last month, Marco Rubio penned an op-ed in the Miami Herald, right? Basically warning countries not to do business with Huawei and Huawei's grand ambitions to really create a 5G global telecommunications.
Huawei being the mega Chinese telecom corporation.
That's correct. And so I expect the Trump administration and the foreign policy led by Secretary Rubio to basically pressure more countries to essentially choose, right? And that's going to be, of course, not necessarily palatable for a lot of our partners, but it's going to be sort of the reality of Trump 2.0.
Right.
Brian
Fonseca, in just the 30 seconds we have left, I can't leave this discussion without asking you, how do you think Rubio will confront Haiti?
That's probably the most difficult question of the session. Again, it's going to go back to a hard approach against sort of the security sector trying to rope more into helping with provision of security while trying to put more pressure and move opposition movements into taking control over the stability of Haiti going forward.
Right.
But it's probably the bigger mess that he has on his hands in the Western Hemisphere for sure.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Brian Fonseca is director of the Gordon Institute at Florida International University. Leland Lazarus is associate director of national security there. Gentlemen, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Finally on the roundup, a reminder that the Miami Book Fair is set to start this weekend through November 24th. Besides the signature street fair at Miami-Dade College's downtown Wolfson campus, there is, of course, a literary cornucopia of events with the fair's featured authors. Next Friday on the South Florida Roundup, we'll talk with three of the fair's local writers about their work. Aisha Elias will direct her discuss her engaging new Miami Beach novel, Pink Glass Houses. And believe me, you'll never look at a school PTA the same again. Haitian American educator Isabel Camille will tell us about her poignant memoir, Sole's Mom, a transgender journey of love, loss, and letting go. And we'll also explore Jeffrey Phillips' new children's book, My Name is Marcus, as well as his rich Jamaica-inspired poetry. It's a show that will be just as good as being at the fair itself. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.